Thanks for listening to this Arrow FM podcast, shared on accessmedia.nz with the support of New Zealand On Air.
Kia ora, everyone. Welcome to Aratoi Pathways to Art. This is our third year, amazingly. We've managed to get to 3 years of this show, which is fantastic. We are here for 2025, the first show of 2025, and I'm with three fabulous artists who I'll introduce in a minute. If you've not listened to our show before, it's a really great show that tells you a little bit more about art and the community and what's going on at Aratoi. It gives you a little bit of an in-depth discussion really about some of the shows that are going on. So this year we've got a huge lineup of really cool artists, from internationals to nationals to, I'm going to drag my boss Sarah McClintock in as well to kind of discuss some exhibitions. So please do have a good listen. If you've missed anything over the last couple of years, just go to Arrow FM and you will get all the podcasts ready to download, ready to listen. So if you don't know who I am, my name is Becky Bateman. I am on the exhibition team at Aratoi, and I had the privilege of helping curate this fabulous show, of which we're going to talk about today, 6x3, with these fabulous three photographers, Tim McMahon, Jim Graydon, and Peter McNeil. Thank you so much, guys, for coming in. I hear we have to call you the Three Musketeers, I heard on Saturday.
Correct.
Yeah, the Three Musketeers. Tim, are you the leader?
We don't have a leader. No. Three Musketeers.
It's a fair description.
Okay. All right. So your show, 6x3, opened at the weekend. Who wants to give me a quick rundown of what the show briefly is all about? He's got to go on. Go on, Tim. Not the leader.
Everybody's looking.
Yeah, go on, Tim. You go first.
6x3 is a collection of, well, 6x3 is 18, right? So there are 18 photographs in the exhibition, by each of us. And the six photographs follow familiar themes. This is going to get complicated. Familiar themes in pairs. So there are two coastal photographs by each of us. There are two inland photographs by each of us. And there are two photographs which feature something built by man at some point or another by each of us.
Not too complicated.
and the point was for us to bring our individual photographic styles, personalities, whatever to them. And then see what came out in terms of comparison, differences, similarities, blah, blah. Blah, blah is not a, not a very fine description, is it?
Blah, blah, blah. Yeah. You know what we mean.
So there you are. That's the in-brief.
Okay, great. So the title 6x3 kind of came quite naturally.
Absolutely. There are three of us.
And you're doing three different...
Six each.
There you go. Yeah. Sometimes it's as simple as that, isn't it? Sometimes the best titles are the obvious ones. Well, as we've introduced the exhibition, do you want to quickly introduce yourselves? Who are you? How did you kind of get started in photography? Your kind of history with taking some of these photos? Jim, do you want to go first?
Yeah, okay. I'm a retired school teacher. I started my photography, I suppose, about 5 years before that, so in total it's about 25 years. I've sort of trod the hard yards because I started in a dark room developing my own black and white film and printing the pictures. But I'm a lazy by inclination, so when the digital thing world came around, I was pretty quick to hook onto that.
Yeah.
It always amuses me to think now I belong to the camera club. And they were ever huffing and puffing when digital first came onto the scene, and we were all convinced it was a passing fad and would shortly disappear, but not now. So since then I've carried on. I two strands to my photography, really. I like taking photos on the street, and I have a background in outdoors, hunting, fishing, that sort of thing. So I've tended to gravitate towards landscape, particularly in the last few years. Yeah.
Awesome. Thank you, Jim. And it's so interesting to hear you talk about kind of the dark room. So it's kind of feel like it's coming back again, you know, like everything does. It's all a bit of a wave, isn't it? Yes. And there's so many people I've been talking to that have gone, oh, I'm just going to get some film camera again, or I'm just going to set up a dark room. So, you know, it's...
15 years ago, you couldn't sell a film camera for cents.
Yeah. My husband's got a film camera from his mother, and we just randomly found it the other day. And he was like, oh, I might give this film thing another go, you know. So it's funny, there's a few people doing it. Tim.
One of the members of the camera club a number of years ago gave me a whole bag of unexposed black and white film.
Yes.
And I've got a Canon film camera. And one of the things I'm going to try and do during this year is run a few films through. And but I don't have access now to a dark room, so I'm sure we'll find somebody in the club who has that. But
I'm sure.
Yeah, something that I'm going to try and do this year is do a bit of film and see what I can learn again.
I like how you're always learning with photography, isn't it? It's not something you're just going to go, I know it all now. There's always something more to learn.
Because we went through my early days of photography was all very little of it was print film with the taking the film down to the chemist to be developed. Mine was all slide film.
So
Colour slides, colour transparencies.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
So I've got thousands of colour transparencies that I took in my earlier days, and so that's something that I'm want to explore those too and see what I can do with some of those images.
I feel there's a little bit of exhibition in that, Peter. In 3 years' time, you're going to say, Becky, I've got this great idea for a photography show. Hey, I've got all these slides in my cupboard. Can I show them off?
You'll have to tune up your self-discipline when you go back to the fact that each slide, you can. Oh. The great thing about digital is you blaze away, and I'm not quite right, so I keep blazing. But with slides, it's a rationing process.
And that's what I suppose, isn't it? With digital, you can have a bit more of a play, and you can overlap things, and you can do things that probably a film camera can't do, I'm assuming.
Oh, lots of things.
Tim. Over to you. What's your history in photography? How did you get into photography?
I got into photography the same way a lot of people did. And I got a cheap camera when my kids were all little, and I stuffed colour film in it, followed them around rivers and, you know, and in the backyard and all, and, you know, snapping away, and then sent the films off to the chemist.
Yep.
And they came back. And after six or seven years, they all faded to nothing. Then gave up for a while. Did a little bit of film processing when I was studying, but didn't ever carry that through, and certainly didn't bother to build or find a dark room to use on my own. You know, Jim says he's lazy by nature, but you can't be if you're doing that sort of thing. And I got back into it... you know, later when I shifted up here to Wellington, that was my kids were in Christchurch when they were little. Well, we were all in Christchurch when the kids were little. coming up here and nearing retirement, which was a long time ago now, 17 years ago, I got a digital camera and started to play about with that. Shooting photographs, and as Jim says, you know, there's there's a temptation to blaze away and look for the one that actually hit the spot. Actually, after a while, you decide that there's just too much hard work looking through all the shots to find out which is the good one if you did that, so you get a little bit more circumspect, I think, after a while. Anyhow, long story short, when I retired, my wife says to me, "You're not going to sit around the house doing nothing all day. For goodness sake, join the camera club." So I did.
Yeah.
And the rest is kind of history.
So did you know each other beforehand, or was it just through the camera club that you...
No, we essentially met through the camera club. I met Peter because the camera club hired the education centre in Dixon Street. Reap was already so we hired it from Reap, who were leasing it from the Trustlands Trust. We met that way. And Jim was a member of the camera club.
I think, except for the current treasurer, I'd be the longest serving member of the club.
I think that's pretty right.
So I go back to the days of black and white pictures and so forth.
Right, and pre-digital.
It was very different.
Yeah.
Peter, what's your history with photography? How did you get into photography?
I've had a camera for some years. I put on the wall at Aratui that... I got a camera for my 21st birthday, an Asahi Pentax Spotmatic. But I actually had a camera earlier than that. It was a little brownie, and I've still got it. But I haven't put a film through that for years and years and years. But they were interesting cameras, those old ones, because they actually had nice big negatives. Mm. They took lovely big negatives. But my parents were – I lived in Gisborne at the time, and my parents were members of the Gisborne Camera Club. And they used to go off to their exhibitions and go off to their days, and I sort of didn't know much about what they were up to. But it actually had some interesting connections because – during the Cook Bicentennial in 1969, Captain Cook came from Whitby, and a photographer came out from Whitby to record the celebrations, and he stayed at our house because my parents hosted him as members of the camera club. But I learned a lot from my father, actually, about photography, and again that was all colour slides. But I just sort of mucked around in the middle years and took photographs of all sorts of things. And I didn't really take that many really good photographs, I think, until latter years, and probably the advent of digital. I've got lots, I've got thousands of transparencies, but one of the things that, as Tim sort of mentioned, it's very easy with a phone or with a camera to just to keep on taking lots of photographs, but taking fewer and spending more time taking them is something that I've certainly learnt to do in later years.
Quality over quantity.
Yeah. If I remember going out with Tim once, and I think in an evening I probably took about 40 or 50 photographs, and Tim came back with about two or three, and he was disappointed with all those. So that was a good lesson for me, to learning about being more deliberate about what we do. So.
I think that's a really interesting thing you're saying, Peter, because I think if you looked at anybody's kind of phone camera nowadays, there'd be thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of photos. And how many of those are actually good photos? Are they memories, or are they actually good photos?
And the question is, will they ever see the light of day other than to be stored up inside the phone somewhere?
Yes. For hundreds of thousands of them. Yep.
I'll give you a rule of thumb here. This is, and I think we all three of us are beholden to this rule.
Okay.
And that is, a photograph is not a photograph unless it's printed.
Ah, okay. I like how you're like, and stop.
Full stop.
Because there are some ways you can still print out kind of digital photos and things, aren't there? There's a few kind of gadgets and things you can have. I know at home, every New Year, we have kind of a selection of like the last year's kind of photos of like where we've been or whatever. And we take them off and we redo like another 30 or 40 and just kind of stick them on the wall, and that's kind of our year. And you're right, that's kind of, they're alive. You remember them, you're like, oh yes, that was when we were in so-and-so, that's whatever and so-so. But you're right, I think if they're just stuck on a phone, who actually kind of looks through?
Who can see them other than the phone owner?
Yeah, absolutely. And all those...
And of course, if you're taking them with other, not the phone, but with other cameras, they sit on a hard drive and nobody sees those.
So how many photos do you have on your hard drives? Hundreds of thousands, I imagine. Or are you quite good and just kind of... Well, Tim, you're not, because you keep fiddling with your photos. Because I think there's even a photo in this exhibition that you took about 10 years ago that you're fiddling with.
Yeah, for sure. Well, the ones that are worth doing anything with and may turn into something really good, you don't... chuck them away. In fact, I'm a terrible hoarder, I have to say. I might have. Some of you will know, and some of the listeners may know, Jeff Walker, who was a prolific photographer around here. Jeff's been in and around.
Yep, he's back again now. I saw him last week. Yeah. He popped in last week.
I don't know what boasted's not the word, but he told me, this was years ago, that he takes around about 50,000 photographs in a year.
Oh, my God.
I think I've got on my hard drive 65,000 collected over 25 years or so.
Do you look back and see the difference between your early ones and the ones you do now?
Yeah, for sure.
Mm. Although, there's quite an element of luck in photography, and particularly I'm thinking of things like street photography, and catching the right moment. Sometimes that opportunity might come very early on in your photography. Some of my photographs I value most are ones I took when I just bought a camera. And one of the worst advice I ever got was when I bought a camera, was somebody said to me, well, just get a nice, inexpensive, entry-level camera, which I did, and I took it travelling, and I had the images, which I now really value, but I'm limited in what I can do with them because of the quality of the camera I took them with. So, yeah, I'm not always true that photography goes on a progression upwards. It goes in different directions. And some of the first are some of the best.
So I think something about this show is that you're trying to show quite a lot of emotion and mood, I suppose, in your photos. And they're all landscapes. There's no people. There's no kind of street scenes. Why did you decide to focus on mood and kind of emotion for this show?
Yeah, that's a good question, wasn't it, Tim? No, I don't think we did decide that, as a collective.
Okay.
Because the idea was to bring each photographer's personal...
So it was quite accidental?
No, not entirely, because we did bring our own thing to it, if you like. And for what it's worth, I went through this, so this is my personal statement now, I went through this thing of trying to make landscape photographs as good as Jim Gradden's, and have always been dissatisfied. And began to experiment more with, well, what happens if I kind of superimpose things that, you know, are kind of more meaningful to me, which took me down this will sound awfully arrogant and almost probably obnoxious, I think, but took me down a kind of fine art photography route. So rather than documenting, you know, what's in front, but rather, you know, trying to make something of what's in front. So it's just a difference, and I think that's probably one of the things we hope to surface out of this.
I mean, in the exhibition, you can see that clearly with Tim's work.
Yeah, I mean, all three of you have got very different styles, but I think as a whole exhibition, it works really well. Just saying, Tim, you're trying to be as good as Jim, but you've got a photograph in the Aratoi collection, so you shouldn't be too upset. And it gets wheeled out every now and again.
Yeah, well.
So you shouldn't be too upset with that, you know. Has Jim got one in the Aratoi collection? Not yet.
No.
Not unless you want to give us one. If they don't sell, you know, just give them to us.
The other thing about the exhibition, Becky, is that we did deliberately try and not replicate each other's work. I had some images that I could have used, but I knew what Tim was doing.
Yeah.
And I didn't want to do that, you know. So we sort of, even though we didn't really see each other's images until maybe till sort of September-ish last year, that we had an idea what each other was doing, because we talked about you know, the things that we were going to do. So we did set out to be different in this exhibition.
All the images are from the Wide App, aren't they? They're all kind of quite classic images, quite well-known landmarks or well-known places in the Wide App. So why did you decide just to focus on this region? Why not go further afield?
Well, that's partly to do with the anticipated audience, I think. I mean, if you want people to say, excuse me, how's his vision different from his vision is different from his vision, then they've got to have some, there's got to be some common linkage.
Yeah, some context too.
And something that links back to the viewer, back to the audience, probably just helps to draw that together.
And I suppose you're inspiring people who kind of go, actually, I know where White Rock is. I'm going to try and do something similar to Peter and go at a particular time of day. Or I've gone down to Castleford, I'll go for a different... slightly different angle to the one that everyone else normally goes to.
Yeah, I think for all three of us are devotees of Central Otago, actually.
Yes, well, that's photos. How I know you three. You'll work from the camera club. It's always Otago.
Coming back to the Wairarapa was, well, not unfamiliar, but I've probably taken less photographs there than I had down south.
I printed an image today from Central Otago that I just love, and it's... but I've converted it into a monochrome for something else which is coming up over this next week. And it's quite different from anything that I put in this exhibition. It's stuff that I've been trying to do for some time. But I didn't want to do that in this exhibition because of what each other was doing. So,
yeah.
Yeah, so we did set out to as it says, to have different interpretations of similar themes. Mm. And we did want them to be sufficiently different that they would, that was obvious. Yeah.
So, Tim, I think when we first discussed this exhibition, you were talking about a particular photographer that inspired you. Is it Ansel Adams?
Yeah, St. Ansel. Ansel Adams.
Yeah. So what was it about what he was talking about that kind of inspired you to kind of get this exhibition idea together?
Well, Ansel Adams photographed over a number of genres, but he was mostly he's mostly known for his landscape photography. Mm. He's mostly known for beautiful black and white photographs. And he's almost as well known for manipulating those photographs in unexpected ways, because he developed everything in the darkroom. There was no such thing as digital. He would have had a field day with the kind of tools that we have now. Mm-hmm. So he would make his negative and then develop and redevelop and redevelop and redevelop prints from those negatives, dodging and burning as they... So that's letting more or less light through onto various parts of the print, again and again and again and again. And so, you know, we talk about editions of a photograph. In the digital age now, the editions can look identical.
Yeah.
And in the old print days, each one was printed individually, and so there were editions, but they all had little differences. And in his case, differences that were quite deliberate, and he would change them.
Yeah, one of the things I take out of Ansel Adams is people often look at your photos and they will say, ah, it's been photoshopped. As if that's necessarily a negative thing. But what they forget is that photographers have always manipulated their images, and Ansel Adams was particularly good at it.
Yeah.
It's just that he had simpler tools, and as Tim said, he would have had to work harder, but he still manipulating the image to try and have it look the way he wants it to look at the end.
That's a nice link into yours, Jim, actually, because your tarn hut, your tarn ridge hut, that's taken with quite a few photos stitched together, isn't it?
Mm. Yeah.
I'll see if I can find a photo, actually, so we can put it up for our people who are watching on YouTube, then you can talk about it. So, start talking and I'll find it.
Well, it's a photo, obviously, looking down along valley of the tarn ridge hut. Into the mountains in the distance, and I wanted to show a broad picture of that, broad view, and the problem with that is if you take one image, that of course the wide angle means that the dramatic things in your sight just recede into the background, and everybody's got the experience of finding those great mountains in the distance, which were so dominant, actually looked like little dots on the horizon on the picture they've took. And a way around that is to take the photo into segments. So instead of taking one photo, I've taken six for that.
Wow, there's six photos in there?
Yeah.
Okay.
And so you divide the thing up, six photos, one by what side, and that means you can pull the landscape forward as far as you want to. Normally, you know, when we look at a landscape looking through our eyes, we're looking at around about a 50 to 60 millimetre. That's what normal. So with these things, I can produce that same sort of effect by sometimes you cheat a little bit, bring it a little bit closer perhaps than your eyes saw, but to try and produce the image as I saw it. As I said to an audience on Saturday, I want my photos to look exactly as if they're standing on the point where I was standing and they've seen it as I saw it.
So you said to me last week that you're quite a keen tramper, but did you tramp up to this one?
Oh, yes. So you're looking in that picture down the very headwaters of the Waianae River, down at the corner, dog legs to the right, and then goes down through a gorge and dog legs further and heads down towards Mitre Flats Hut, which a lot of people will know of. And that was my playground for 30 years. That was my favourite place in that river valley. So I walked a lot of the Tararuas, but that particular catchment, I know it well. So I did actually walk up there a few times. Yes.
It's making me feel quite a bit of vertigo just looking at that image.
Yeah, me too, actually.
don't forget, he's made it look steeper.
That's true. Yeah, hang on.
Actually, Bannister's got the steepest slopes in the Tararuas, just as a point of interest. Mm.
So I really like what you've done with the composition here, Jim. I imagine that was on purpose, that you've kind of got this valley kind of really dragging your eye in, and then this beautiful bright red hut. kind of on that perfect little spot.
I just like to, if I can, give a sense of space in my thing, and also in landscapes, if I can intrude a small human presence, but one which sort of emphasises the insignificance of the human contribution, you know.
Yes.
Sort of a lonely feeling, if you like.
It is, isn't it?
In the hut. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. So just talk me through how you stitch them together, because I imagine if people are not used to stitching photos, they kind of go, well, I can't see any lines there. How do you actually join them together?
Well, we did know a photographer, didn't we, Tim, who actually used to take these six photos and he used to cut them.
No.
Painstakingly glue them, and I would never have tried that. You can stitch them together relatively simply in Photoshop. You have to make sure that the exposures, all the exposure readings are the same for all of the photos. And you've got to make sure, of course, that they line up, because otherwise you're not going to get... But it's not a difficult process. It can be done quite easily.
I suppose then you have to take all the photos on the same day, or can it be over a couple of hours?
You've got to have the same... The same light conditions. Has to be consistent. So, okay. So you have to do it all at once.
So to do that, not just the same day, they really have to be taken... Immediately. The whole six or seven images... really need to be shot within about 10 minutes.
Very quickly. Okay.
Yes. You frame it up and then you go click, 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 click.
So if you were trying to take that photo in just one, kind of one photo, would it just not
work? What would happen is that the hut and the grass in the foreground might look much the same.
Right.
But the river valley and the mountains would look far away and much smaller and much less dramatic, you know.
I think you'd have to be using a wide-angle lens. Seeing more than your eye would see, whereas that sees what your eye sees.
That's it, is it? That's the beauty of that one, is it? You can just imagine you're there.
My feeling on panoramas is that when we look at views as people, we don't look through blinkers.
Yes.
You know, we look from side to side, and we get our eye, of course, gives us the correct perspective, but it's trying to get the camera to do that for you.
So why did you stop at those mountains? Why didn't you go further?
Well, because both sides of it, the high ridge behind the hut, and you can see the beginnings of the high ridge on the other end, on the right-hand side of the photo, that provided a sort of a natural frame for what I was taking. And what I wanted was to emphasise that hut and that particular environment. Mm.
And going back to when we were talking earlier about kind of emotion and mood, it is quite a lonely but also quite comforting, I suppose, photograph, isn't it? That, yes, you might have this little kind of human presence, but actually the world goes on without us.
There are some places where there aren't too many people.
Yes. What were you trying to... Is that kind of the mood you were trying to get with that photo?
Well, if you knew me, it's the sort of thing over my lifetime I've done a lot of, and I like being alone in wide spaces. And
it's perfect, then.
Yeah, so I like to try and transfer that where it fits into my photos,
I think it's a really beautiful one, and we've put this one right at the back of the gallery, kind of right in the middle, haven't we? So as soon as you kind of walk into the space, boof, it's right in front of you. So I think someone's going to be very lucky to have that on their wall. I think it's
They will be.
or you can always gift it to Adatoy, and you can go, hey, Tim, I've got one Adatoy too. just saying. All right, well, let's take that one off for the moment. Because I think it's time for some musical interlude. Because obviously, look, boys, guys, it's already 1:30. We've only been going for half an hour. It's going to go quickly. So whose music shall we have first? Shall we have Tim's? We'll do you, Jim, as we've just been talking about you. Jim, do you want to tell us
somebody,
about the piece of
music? When I was asked to provide some music, the sort of music I listened to while I was taking photographs, I was a bit stumped because I don't listen to music while I was taking photographs. So I thought, I suggested as a joke that one of my favourite bands, which was Creedence Clearwater, who plays sort of folk rock stuff.
Revival, even.
Yeah, Creedence Clearwater Revival. And then I thought, well, there's got to be something relevant in there. So I chose the track As Long As I Can See the Light. It's the refrain which keeps repeating to it. And I think it photography, I guess, as long as I can see the light, I'll keep on taking photos.
I like it. Oh, that's a good story. Because, yeah, I do admit that I often ask people who come onto the show to give me a piece of music that, you know, they listen to what they're painting. But, yeah, I didn't really think, probably photographers don't really listen to that much when they're out taking photos. So thank you, Jim, for trying to make at least a link to photography there. All right, let's get this going. And we'll listen to your... choosing that piece of music, although we were chatting all the way through it, I didn't actually hear a single word of it, but I might go back and have a re-listen to that, and I really like how there's those photographs kind of on a bit of a loop for that video, so thank you, Jim. Tim, over to you, Tim. Tim, I'm going to pop up a photo.
Right.
I want you to tell me a little bit about it, because Tim, yours are all quite different. Yours are all black and white, aren't they, compared to... Peter's got some colour and Jim's all basically in colour. Yours are all black and white, so I'm going to just pop... That's the one. Here it is. Oh, no, there we go. Tim, this beautiful...
Good,
now, again, if you're not online or you're listening to us on the radio, you can go onto the YTV channel and actually have a look at these photos, or just come into Adatoy, in fact, and come and have a look. But, Tim, do you want to tell us about this photo? What's it called, first of all?
It's called Manga Titi Falls.
Good.
it's a waterfall which is on the whole family farm at Pungaroa.
Okay.
And It's a very spectacular waterfall because it falls up. You can see at the top of it, if you can see that projection, there's a limestone ridge, kind of, you know, that's all scoured out underneath, and the water just tips over the edge of that and then falls vertically down, and it's just really quite spectacular, particularly if there's been a bit of rain and it's yep. falling. Just sort of context is the whole black and white thing. Just for what it, I mean, this again, I risk sounding poncy here, and I kind of don't want to do that. But on the other hand, I think it's part of the contextual thing. I was reading, ironically this morning, I got an email, amongst the huge number of emails that come in from people trying to sell stuff and all sorts of other things. There's a photographer who's an architect called Julia Anna Gospodaro. She's a Greek, but she runs workshops all around the world now. She started out doing architectural photography, and now she runs all sorts of workshops on black and white photography.
Okay.
And just in amongst what she sent this morning, she sent a kind of rationale for that, and it's expressed better than I can do it. So do you mind if I read it?
Absolutely,
right.
Go for it.
Right, she said, "Fine art photography is not about reproducing reality, but about transforming it into a personal artistic statement. Black and white abstracts the world, going beyond literal representation and encouraging us to interpret the subject in a more expressive and imaginative way." And I think that's right, because black and white, the world is not black and white. And so immediately you drop colour, you take away some of the things which are part of the reality, part of the document, and leave you then working with something that's more imaginative. This particular photograph is it goes back to an idea. When I first took the shot, now this is the one you were talking about, was first shot in 2014.
Mm.
Happened to be a Rural Women's Day, a fundraiser that the Hull family were had put on, and the camera club all went along, and we fought our way through Blackberries to get a spot. Can we actually see this?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, you can hold it up if you like.
The camera's there. Now the camera's there. Right, okay. So this photograph here is what came out of the camera originally.
Yeah.
Right, in 2014. Now, when I look at that photograph, you can see it wasn't a fantastic day. There was, greyish cloud over the top. There's no significant shadow detail. The photograph is actually quite uninteresting, and yet there's this powerful water going on. So there's an idea in this, but how do you get that powerful water out of it? And so the first thing I tried somewhere about 3 or 4 years later was to make it... Here we are. It's to turn it into a black and white shot. And then that is considerably different, because now you can see a little bit more of the water here. You also see the spray coming up. So that's, in my view, quite a nice representation of the idea that was growing, this idea of how do I project the power and noise and everything of the water. And then as we were coming towards this exhibition, I resurrected the photograph again and said, can we take this even further? And the idea I had was that, well, if this is really about the falling water and the splashing and the verticality and all that sort of stuff, let's abstract all of the background out of it. And so we use the we use just the notion of really high contrast you've got it up there. To separate the water from the rest of the picture, but still providing enough detail in the background that people can sort of get a context for it. That technique in the old days, Rembrandt used to paint like this, using a technique called chiaroscuro, which is about really bringing out the brights but fading off the blacks. I just thought it it actually works. And it does much better, projects the idea than the original.
You can almost kind of hear the loud rushing water just by looking at that, can't you? It's quite dramatic. Yeah. No, I think that's, would you take it any further? Would you do something else to it next? Or do you think this is kind of final?
You could, but I'd probably start at a different point. I've got another shot of it, and I might actually have made it just a little different to bring out a little bit more of what's happening at the bottom of the waterfall, but I'm quite pleased with the way it works.
No, I think it's fabulous. Because a lot of your photos they're obviously all black and white, but they're all, I'm not going to say moody, but they all do give a different sense of emotion, don't they? Because I think the one of your church, is it the
Wild Island Lake, All Saints. Yeah.
So you've done that. Let's see if I can find an image of that one. Because that's quite an interesting one to talk about, because you've kind of made it... here we go. I just popped that on for everybody. Do you want to talk about what you did to this church? Because it's almost like these kind of rays are coming out of it.
Yeah. Well, look, most photographers in the Wild Arapa have photographed this church over and over.
It's a very familiar church to many people, isn't it?
And I've probably been down there... 50 or 60 times at various times over the last 25 years. Mm. And what I've normally tried to focus on is the texture in the it's not concrete. What do they call it? Is it concrete? The wall?
Stucco.
You know, it's very, very big pebbles in the stucco. And it's quite pleasant. Anyway, for this photograph, I went down four times to get this. The first time I went down, it was raining, and I had to stand under a tree so as not to get drenched and the camera not to get drenched, and so the position wasn't exactly right. But I could see some really interesting things happening in the rain. So that gave me a bit of an idea, and I had the notion that we could make a really interesting photograph by using the church itself as a frame, so filling the whole photograph with the church, and then putting it again sharply right in the middle. which I should have done with just two separate shots and then overlaid them. But I thought I was going to be very clever, and I used the zoom lens instead. So I zoomed in on the zoomed in to the church where it is, and then zoomed out to a wide angle. And what happens, lo and behold, is the white parts of the church exposed more on the digital sensor than the black parts, and so you got those ray looking things. And all of a sudden it began to tell a story about churches.
Yes, absolutely.
And so I thought, I rather like it.
I had always assumed that you'd kind of put this ray kind of thing, over the top. But is that actually from...
No, it's actually from the white parts of the church.
All made in camera.
Made in camera, I mean, you have to use... some of Ansel Adams' tools in order to bring them out a bit and make sure that they can actually be seen to their optimum. But it is all made in camera. There's nothing introduced by paintbrushes or anything.
Very good. Okay, well, before we run out of time, Tim, we're going to have your piece of music. Oh, I've just closed it. That's annoying. Do you want to tell us about your piece of music that you have chosen?
Which one was it?
It was good old Paul Simon.
Oh, right. Yeah. Well, there's a great irony in this, because Paul Simon's song here, Kodachrome, is about photographing in colour.
Right.
And he says at one point, everything looks worse in black and white. So, okay. I just think that's quite appropriate.
Okay, well, we're going to listen to... sod already. We're going to listen to this one. And then, Peter, we're going to come to you and have a chat about your photographs. All right.
When I think back on all the crap I learned in high school,
to wonder, I can't think at all. And my lack of education hasn't hurt me none. I can read the writing on the wall. Cold or cold, in black and white.
Thank you, Tim. That was a fabulous one. I do like Paul Simon, so I'm going to have to go and investigate a bit more of Paul Simon. Thank you for that one. Peter, lucky last.
Yeah, lucky last, yes.
Lucky last. Peter, tell me about your idea.
That's because I'm the youngest.
Well, that's true. You know, age before beauty. No, hang on, hang on. Peter, tell me about the idea kind of spanning your six photographs, because you've got quite a different set to the other two, haven't you, about your idea?
Yeah, they are very different. And I had this something I've been working at for quite a while now is how do we look at how do we try and show what we can't see easily ourselves. So I set out to show what things might look like if they were taken over a period of time. So every one of those photographs, none of them are short exposures. The longest of them is almost 5 minutes. Mm. And the shortest of them is a fifth of a second, which is enough to show movement. And when we get to it, there is a photograph there that shows like a blade turning around.
Oh, yes, in fact, I've got that one. All right. Let's pop that one up.
Okay, so these are the last three turbines at Honui, east of Martinborough. There's 15 turbines in all, and these turbines were the last three to be put up. And I was interested in making sure that we could show movement in the images. I made number of trips out. I've been out there, goodness knows how many times, but this year I made three separate trips. And I showed one of the ideas I had to Tim, and Tim said,
I can imagine you doing that too. I can imagine.
Somebody said, else said to Tim, you know, I think you should have another look. So that fifth of a second is enough to show those blades turning around. And I mentioned the other day at the talk that when we see photographs that are taken of things like air shows, some people were very pleased with their photographs, and the planes are very still in the sky, and there's no movement, and the propellers aren't moving, and you're sort of, you know, waiting for the plane to fall down, really. Mm. And yet photographs that show movement in the propellers, you get a sense of that they're flying.
It's quite dynamic, isn't it?
Yeah. So our eyes can't actually see that, what that long movement looks like, because of the way that they're constructed. So that's what I set out to do, and I really like I particularly like the road and the fence
as they sort of
lead away and lead up into those turbines at the top. Mm. Taken quite late in the afternoon, and I haven't done a lot to that image at all, actually.
I always quite like that it's quite a cloudy day. I think if it was a blue sky.
That direction was quite cloudy, but if I turn around almost 180 degrees from there, I actually had been photographing some other turbines and waiting for the sun to set on, waiting for them to go for the sort of golden on the towers. And it was very fleeting, and then I turned around and that's what I saw. I thought, that's what really interests me. Yeah.
So I think I really like the way you've composed it, because I think the fence and the road both really draw your eye in, don't they, to those wind turbines? Because the wind turbines are actually quite small. They're about a third of the size of the picture. Yeah. But actually, your eye travelling up that road.
There's something else about that intrigues me, and nobody else in the world would be intrigued by it. But there's a few sheep in there.
Is that?
And there's some little sort of whitish dots. There's not too many, but there's a few sheep up in that paddock. And here's me being all intentional and watching those turbines, and those sheep don't care those turbines are there. They just go about their day eating and going. They don't care about any of that stuff. And I think it's quite interesting how for me that sort of they have that sort of carefree thing about the world, and they just get on and do their thing, and people like me scurry around and you know, try and do other things. Yeah, so I quite like that photo.
If I could be so bold as to make one comment on Peter's photograph.
Of course.
I think if you raise a finger or a couple of fingers and block out the light on the top of that little hill in the foreground of the picture,
yep.
Right? If you block that out, it changes completely.
It does, doesn't it?
And it's that light makes a huge difference. It's the contrast there really makes that photograph, I think.
Yeah.
Now, Peter, is this just one single image, or are you stitching here like...
No, that's a single image.
That's a single image.
Yeah, yeah.
Because all your photos, they're all over timescales, aren't they? And I think there's one photo which, unfortunately, I didn't bring with me. There's another... Hang on a minute. You've got a theme of power, haven't you, and energy in your photos of the dam.
There's another photograph that you'll see at when you pop along to Aotearoa that I'm sure all of you are going to. That shows one of the surge towers, the bottom surge tower at the Kuraro Dam, coming down just east of Gladstone. And it's an interesting photo in many ways, but that photograph is almost 5 minutes in exposure. And when you look at it, you won't realise that. You won't understand why. And I'd taken a number of photographs there of that exact same area, and I was I fiddled around with them, and I was really unhappy with them, particularly because of the way the light fell. And I was coming back one night from symphony orchestra visit from Wellington, and there was a full moon. Mm. And I could see the way the shadows were falling from the trees at night in the dark, well, with the moon lighting them behind them. So I had this idea, and so I went out the next night at about 10:30 to the exact same spot, wearing my head torch and carrying my tripod, and set it up, and I took a number of exposures, but this was actually the first photo I took that night, and I guessed it would need to be a very long photograph because it was almost completely dark, even with the moonlight there. So that photograph is actually taken at night time, and you can to get the angle of the light going, the shadows going up the hill to the left, with the sun, you just couldn't do it with the sun in the middle of the day or early morning or late afternoon.
So. It's one of my favourite photos, Peter. So if you want to donate that onto Aratoy, you're more than welcome. But no, I love it that you can see these shadows, and people will often walk past and they don't realise that photo's from the middle of the night, basically.
What I was trying to do too was to emphasise the tower by getting it to shine, and with the sun. With the sun was quite flat on it, the sunlight, and you can't get a sunset on it because the sun sets in the west.
Right.
And I was looking towards the west. I was sort of looking towards the southwest, and so you just couldn't do it. Yeah. So, but the moon was shining. You can't see the moon in the photograph.
It's behind you,
It's sort of out to my right.
Yeah.
But it lights up the tower, which is what I was trying to achieve. Yeah.
Well, there you are, everyone. If you go into Aratoy, go and have a proper look at that photo and go, that's done in the middle of the night on a full moon, not in the middle of the daytime. Hey, we're almost out of time, guys, but I did want to ask you one more question. And it's something I ask a lot of our artists when they come in, is this project finished? Are you going to now, are you inspired by each other's work to go and do something else? Or are you kind of gone, oh, actually, I could have put another 20 images in. Is there something that you would change or something you would do differently? Or, you know, is this project finished? Oh, I like Peter's looking at Tim there. You're both looking at Tim, actually. So, like, Tim, what do you think? Looking Tim, can I ask you, Tim, is this project finished?
Well, I think these two guys are both saying, don't you dare.
There was a bit of art look, wasn't there?
Just from my perspective, one of the reasons I approached, or you and I had a discussion a couple of years ago about this possibility.
It's been a couple of years in the making, hasn't it?
It was because my good friend, and a shout out to Rebecca Kempton from down in Greytown, who admonished me one day about not being creative enough. And this was at a time when I was angsting over these flat landscapes that I wasn't enjoying. Be more creative, she said. I don't know how, you know, I didn't know how you could do that. And so the photographs here are part of a journey there. So I don't think that journey's going to finish, although my life might, but it's a whole different thing. You know, I could see us going, see it going on from that perspective. Whether my fellow musketeers want to trail along is a whole other question.
Oh, they're both stroking their faces going,
we need to discuss over a cup of coffee.
There may be something stronger.
Or something stronger, yeah. Yes.
Because we'll see you three in the One Up a Camera Club at the end of the year, I'm sure, won't we? You'll be putting some photos in?
About July.
About July, we've got the biannual Wired Upper Camera Club exhibition, and I'm hoping to see, you know, some more Central Otago images, perhaps.
Yeah, we've certainly got some of those, yes. Yeah.
Yeah. So the exhibition is going on until the 4th of May, Star Wars Day,
Star Wars Day?
Yeah, 4th. May the 4th be with you. Yeah, Peter's happy about that, thank you. on at Aratoy, 4th of May. Do come and have a look. It will open Tuesday to Sunday, 10 till 4, so plenty of time to come and have a look. And yeah, just make sure you do me a favour, and every time you go past Peter's surge tower, go, that's done in the middle of the night, you know. Just thank you so much, you three, for coming. So Tim, Jim and Peter, thank you so much for joining me on our first one of the year. What a high standard for the rest of the year, frankly. Sarah's better be on top form next month when we talk about our upcoming autumn programme with Sarah McClintock, the Aratoy director. No pressure, Sarah. But thank you very much, guys. Have a lovely afternoon, and talk to you next month.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Becky.